Hello, welcome to another episode. It's Everything is Canon, the Cinelings podcast, the podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Dunk, and however you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, then you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. Yes, that's Sam Witwer. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. Check it out if you haven't. It's awesome. Today, we're lucky enough to have not one, but two great guests. We've got Alexander Freed, author of the just-released Star Wars Shadow Fall, the second book in the Alphabet Squadron trilogy, and Elizabeth Schaefer, the creative director of Del Rey Books, and who also happens to be this trilogy's editor. We go fairly deep into the process and how vital the relationship is between an author and their editor, and here's two of the best. This is a spoiler discussion, so please, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but double back after you've read the book and listen to it then. Enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. And I don't want to waste too much time with introductions, but that's just what you do these days. You introduce people. So with me today is Alexander Freed. He's the author of a few Star Wars books you might have heard of: Battlefront, Twilight Company, Rogue One, last year's Alphabet Squadron, and the brand new Star Wars Shadowfall, an Alphabet Squadron novel. It's a wordy title, but it's good. And it's also the second book in the suitably titled Alphabet Squadron trilogy. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be on.
Lucky for us, lucky for Alex, we're not alone, and he has this person in his life. We have a VIP with us today as well. She's also an author herself, several titles, in fact. Elizabeth Schaefer is currently a senior editor and creative director at Del Rey Books. She happens to be the editor on Alex's Alphabet Squadron trilogy so far, the two that have come out. Anyways, I assume they won't break ranks and pull you away from the third. They could try, but
I would not let them.
So, Elizabeth, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. And I don't know all about that VIP nonsense, but I'm glad to be here.
And very quickly, you know, we don't know what things are going to be happening when this airs a couple of weeks from now. But I'd just like to say, and I think I can speak for all of us, that anyone out there who is peacefully protesting and putting themselves in harm's way, please be as safe as you can. And let's look out for each other. And a very, very happy Pride Month to all of our friends and family in the community. Elizabeth, last time you and I spoke was last July. Actually, it's been a while. And we talked about a lot of stuff, but we did talk about Alphabet Squadrons, the first book. You know, I was gushing about it, going on about Alexander and all this stuff. And you told me I'm quoting you. You said, "I just got the outline," talking about the second book. "I just got the outline. You won't be disappointed." That now seems like the understatement of the year. Because I've read Shadowfall now. Well, we didn't know it was Shadowfall at the time. Did you even have a title back then? In last July, would you have had the title?
Oh my gosh, huh? I'm trying to think through the timeline. Probably not. Those usually come together pretty close to when we do the announcements and the cover reveal.
Right. Yeah, I think we had a list of maybe like a dozen title candidates that we had sort of thrown together at that point, but nothing final.
Okay. I remember when I heard the title. I think it was it in New York?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yes, that would have been it.
Yeah, Comic Con's when they announced it. Yeah, that's a huge understatement because, like I was just saying to you folks offline, man, do I love this book. And I think it's genius. And I really think I'm struggling. I feel like it's my favorite Star Wars book of all time. So I need to put myself into some meditation chamber and really, you know, decide if that's going to be the case or not, because that's a bold statement, right, with us Star Wars fans and readers. So I'm going to work my way through it. So, Elizabeth, I know I would never get you to admit that all, you know, manuscripts are created equal. So I'm just going to ask you, is it fun editing an Alexander Freed novel?
Oh, my gosh. It's such a delight. I'm going to disappoint you in this interview because I feel like I've made some editorial comments along the way. Alex comes in with such a clear vision of the story he wants to tell, and then you know you can trust him to execute it so brilliantly. So it's an absolute delight to edit Alex.
And Alex, is it fun to work with Elizabeth?
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, Elizabeth has been fantastic at I mean, one, just sort of working with whatever idiosyncrasies I'm throwing at her in a given week. You know, she's been incredibly accommodating. She's also very good, and this is a, I think, underrated quality in editors or underappreciated. She's very good at triaging, right? She's very good at making it clear, okay, here are the important problems to solve. Here are the things that, you know, are bothersome, but don't waste time on them. You know, if this is, don't get caught up in this if we need to solve that. Shadowfall involved more editorial work and back and forth and discussions than the last two projects that we worked on. And I was very, very grateful for her her patience with me throughout.
I think that's often true of second books, right? There's so many little pieces that have to line up, not just with book one, but with book three, where everything is going. So that was always going to be the case.
Well, yeah, it's the anchor, right? I mean, it's the cream in the Oreo. Like, you can't have, you know, it's, you can't have the it's the creamy, wonderful filling in the Oreo that you're right. If it doesn't tie into the first, it could really throw the whole thing off.
The bottom
track
of your Oreo is going to fall off.
Thank you. That's what I was trying to say. Did Elizabeth write the publisher summary, like the official summary, or who wrote that?
Oh, that is a wonderful, wonderful member of our team, Alex Davis, who often writes most of the copy from our Star Wars books. He's a newer member of the team. He's only been here for a couple years now, but immediately cemented himself as being able to write amazing copy. So that's all him.
He deserves a nebula for this one. I don't know. Like, I don't know how. It's funny because I was thinking about it. I'm like, geez, how do you summarize Shadowfall, right? I mean, I could say, you know, Harrison Dula and the New Republic are setting a trap for Soren Keys and the Shadow Wing outside of Cerberon. I guess I could just say that, right? But that's not why you summarize books. His summary is fantastic. So Alex, I guess I don't know why they'd be listening to this specific podcast if they didn't know, but maybe just give us a little, let's pick up in action here. Tell us sort of what Shadowfall is about and sort of what sort of precarious situation do we find our alphabets in?
Sure. So, you know, at the end of the first book, Alphabet Squadron, the sort of the five pilots working under Hera and New Republic Intelligence had sort of come together and delivered a fairly forceful blow to Shadow Wing, the elite Imperial TIE fighter unit. Shadow Wing sort of slunk off into the night, and where we start Shadowfall, Alphabet and the rest of Harrison Dula's battle group are sort of engaged in military operations in one particular star system, the deep core world of Cerberon, which orbits around a black hole. And they're still officially on Shadow Wing hunting duty, but they don't quite know how to get there. Shadow Wing, meanwhile, has just found its new leader in the returned Soren Keys and is starting to figure out, all right, well, what are we doing? How do we rebuild? And do we want to get revenge? And that's sort of where we start out.
It's funny because I like how sort of Shadow Wing is at this point anyways is elusive to the New Republic group, but not because of cunning or stealth at this point, right? It's more just because they're in disarray a little bit. We have this huge void after Grandmother was murdered, and it's like they're sort of like a bunch of little pieces, you know what I mean? They don't, the head of the snake has been cut off, right? So they're sort of like fumbling until, and then, you know, Soren Keys is back. And although I miss Devin quite a bit, but he's great. He's a great character because he's a realist in a lot of ways, right? He understands the state of things. He's loyal, but he understands the Empire is never going to be what it was.
Yeah, I mean, he's a realist in sort of strategic terms, and you know, I think he is an idealist in certain respects, but he's not an imperial idealist.
Right.
Right. He's not a true believer in the empire. He has very, very clear principles that he will go quite far for. But those are not the empire must rise again.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, when you're looking at, you know, a trilogy of books, obviously it's got to make sense all the way through. And then so bringing, what was it about bringing Soren for book two, you know, that sort of got you excited or thought, you know, this is the perfect way to get him back into the fold?
Oh my gosh, he's such a good villain, question mark. I love, one of my favorite things that Alex has done in this book is we're so used to narratives in Star Wars of the scrappy rebels who are standing against an overwhelming empire. And in Shadowfall, because it takes place after, you know, Return of the Jedi and the New Republic is already starting to form and become more stable, we're seeing that flipped and watching these people with imperial sensibilities try and figure out how to be not rebels, but an insurgent force fighting for survival and not just complete galactic dominance. That's really interesting. And to see Keys or Kyze, is his name is Kyze? I've been pronouncing it wrong all this time. Sorry, Alex. Kyze.
I've been saying Keys too. I say Keys, yeah.
Hey, tomato, tomato. But yeah, to see him step into that role and be that leader for the Empire, I think is what makes him so compelling and so different from the other, again, villain question marks that we've seen in Star Wars.
Yeah, villains. I get what you're saying. You know, he's really rides that line. And I think because, and Alex, maybe jump in here too, because, you know, Soren is a likable guy, kind of, right? I mean, it's not, he's got his issues, but at the same time, he's also seems like an honorable person at the end of the day.
I think he's a likable guy. I think part of the other reason for the question mark on villain there is less about him and what he's doing and more about the fact that our sort of our core protagonist, if you want to sort of put Erica Quell in the spotlight, it's hard to argue that she's that much better than him.
Right.
Right. Like the
right.
She is in a better position and she is doing better things at the moment, but you know, deep down in her soul, you know, they're not wildly far apart. And to a certain extent, I think the gravity of our heroes actually makes it seem like Soren is maybe not as bad as he is.
I like to use the word gravity because I do want to talk about gravity. But I think, you know, Soren, to me, I think what you've done so great here, and Elizabeth talk about it a bit too, is these characters really very much represent the time in which they exist, right? The state of the galaxy. And, you know, Alex, you've crafted all these great characters that like are perfectly matched for this time in which they exist, Soren included. This strikes me as, you know, I think Shadowfall at Alphabet Squadron, the trilogy is the gold standard for what that the galaxy looks like at that point in time. How important is it to, what I'm trying to say is there's not a lot of piggybacking in this trilogy, right? Like, you know, I don't even think you say the word lightsaber once. I think maybe once. You certainly don't mention Han Solo or Luke. You know what I mean? None of the heroes of the rebellion are even mentioned. How important is it to both of you that you represent this point, the timeline, in the truest manner that you can?
Huh. So I'm really interested in Elizabeth's answer to this one, but I will I will field it first. You know. And the reason I say that is because obviously I'm not looking at this from sort of a line-wide perspective. All I have to worry about is the book that I'm writing.
Right.
You know, and for me, the time period was immensely appealing because it is relatively unexplored, right? There's really not a whole lot aside from the Aftermath trilogy and a handful of comics in that immediate post-Andor period. And there are a lot of just huge thematic questions that the time period naturally brings up. And one of the challenges of writing Star Wars is always finding new thematic ground, right? Like the films have such a strong cohesive set of themes and ideas and archetypes that it's always dangerous to stray far from them. So when a clear opportunity for, oh, this arises out of the films, but it is different, for me, that's what I seize on.
Yeah, I think there's what is so exciting about this trilogy, I can articulate in both a creative way and also in a pragmatic way. In a creative way, I love that when you really stop to think about the end of Return of the Jedi, yeah, that was just one battle. That was just the Emperor and Vader. I almost said Voldemort. Vader going down, which of course is going to really hinder the Empire, but it's not like it's all over. And that it's not over from both a needing to clean up the, you know, systemic power structures that have been the backbone of the galaxy for about 1923 years, if my timeline is correct. And that is a hard thing to do. And I think the pilots of Alphabet Squadron are this microcosm of how difficult sorting through victory, if it is victory, can be. And that's why it's so compelling. And then from just a practical point of view, I love how much it stands alone. Like you still get Hera. So you have that tie to the familiar world of Star Wars. And it's a really natural place for her to be, but it just offers such wonderful freedom to be able to tell a story that has a beginning, middle, end. And that's really, these characters are the star of this story. It's not that they are, you just really wish Luke Skywalker would come on stage halfway through because he's the hero of the Star Wars movies. He's not the hero of this story. These folks are.
Yeah. And that's one of the cool things that, you know, talk about sort of like finding a rhythm. And, you know, as an editor, this must be incredibly important to you. You know, I don't know the word count, but it feels like every character. I don't. It feels like
Alex.
It feels,
that word Alex, count. Huh? Yeah. Sorry, no, keep going.
Yeah, 1 million. Each character. It feels like each character is equally represented on page. It's like you don't have. I know Yurika is kind of the lead, I guess, but God, it feels like you give each person the appropriate amount of time. Is that kind of the way you are thinking when you're writing it, that you want there? You have five leads. You don't have one. Is that sort of how you look at it? Or do you always make sure, well, you know, Nath and Will got to get some time in, but I got to make sure I circle back because this whole thing flows through Yurika. It started with Yurika. It's got to end with Yurika.
Yeah. I mean, so figuring out how to balance our main cast members, has been one of the most challenging things from the start of book one, like from the outlining stages. So going back a little bit, you know, when the idea for all of this came up, you know, Del Rey and Lucas approached me with the basic concept of post-Endor, you know, Alphabet Squadron, five pilots, you know, different ships, you know, fighting elite Imperials. And that was the core of the concept. The characters weren't there, but, you know, built in there was, okay, you've got five. And I sort of felt like, all right, well, I guess doing one character and the five is, and, you know, the other four is just supporting cast, didn't feel quite right for the Alphabet Squadron concept. So it wasn't a challenge I could escape. And honestly, like, I spent so much time trying to figure out, all right, so exactly how many words across three books am I going to be able to, you know, give each individual character, because I have a sense of, you know, what does a fulfilling character arc across a single novel take. But once I split that, you know, into across three books and then have five characters, how does it add up? How do I arrange the scenes? How do I pace it? So that is my constant struggle with these books, and I'm still learning as I go. I know you had a question in there, and I just started rambling, but
yeah, I think it's just really like, I don't even know if there was a question. It was more just like a compliment, is like how wonderfully balanced it feels. And, and again, this, and then Elizabeth, please jump in on this one, but like the chapter breaks to me are perfect. Also a very quick side shout out. I love that you title your chapters. I love that. I love it when books do that. I know there's not a lot of Star Wars books that do that. And I know you do, and I love that. Anyways.
It's impressive because titles are hard. So the idea that you would choose to need to think of like 37 more titles, it's very impressive.
It's very impressive. But the chapter breaks are perfect. Like at no point do I feel like I was away from any one character for too long, and I don't feel like you hung around one character for too long. Obviously, you make it easy on yourself by having like Nath and Will in the same place a lot of the time and stuff like that. But Elizabeth, just talk about like sort of how that flow and making sure everyone gets a chance to shine. And but at the same time, he's also God, he introduces so many new characters in this book.
It's interesting. I think this is one of the few books that got shorter between the first draft and the final draft. I'm remembering that correctly, right, Alex?
You are. It wasn't a lot. You know, we made some cuts, but also some additions. But the final difference was we cut 3,000 or 5,000 words.
Yeah. Which it's pretty unusual for Star Wars. I think oftentimes it's when you're going back to revise, it's about filling out things that need a little more meat on the bones. So I think that was a really nice position to be in as an editor of just being able to try and suggest Michelangelo style of like, we've got the almost completely carved block of marble, but where are those few extra little cuts that will make it really beautiful?
Mm-hmm. It's Alex, your language is so specific to me. It's like, I'm a huge fan of like linguistic relativity and like the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, right? That if you learn a new language, like, you know, as you learn a new language, your brain actually changes, right? Uh-huh. And I find that with your books, I find you have such a specific writing style, and it takes me, you know, a few pages, a chapter even, but then I feel like my brain start to like adapt and get used to your style. Cause I don't find it's like anybody else's. There's no question there at all. It's just me telling you, I think
it's like when you go see a great Shakespeare play,
right? That's a great example. That's how I feel. Like, I feel like I'm learning a new language every time I read an Alexander book. And then my brain takes a few minutes, a few pages, a chapter, even just to like, you know, get used to that. And then it gets rewired, and then boom, you're going. But then when I leave that and I hit, like, I'm usually got two or three things on the go at the same time, reading wise, cannot go back to something else right away. It takes me time. I have to, like, you know, my brain needs to be unwired, I guess, if that's the right way to say it. But Elizabeth, do you find like editing Alexander's books different, challenging? How do you, is there anything?
Oh, so there? Challenging. You know, I bet you can tell he's pretty temperamental, really high maintenance. No, not at all. I think Alex writes really, really clean. I'm almost a little bit embarrassed to be on this call because, like, yeah, I threw out a few ideas, but Alex is very, very good at what he does. And I appreciate that, you know, we've alluded to a little bit, but I think it's interesting to talk about Alex's style of outlining. I think is really helpful for me as an editor, that he'll write these very, very long, detailed outlines so that I'm able to note if I think there's anything that's going to be problematic well before he's invested the time to flesh out the writing, and could be really demoralizing to go back and try and change something.
One of the really cool things that he did write for this book, and Alex, so like, well, like we've talked a couple times, this chapter anyways takes place predominantly, other than I guess the occasional, there's a couple of sort of talkbacks and flashbacks, but we're in the Cerberon system. And what's unique about the Cerberon system currently is that it's being destroyed by a singularity. So one of the things I did a bit of reading on was like the psychological effects of living, if you had to live on a planet near a black hole. That obviously doesn't exist, so people are just hypothesizing, right? You know, the scientists are doing what they do. Talk about, you know, your idea to use to base this around a black hole, a singularity in the Cerberon system, the Cerberon singularity, I guess. And if that, you know, where you came up with that idea, talk about your, you know, working through that idea, how it has an effect on all the characters, because it does have an effect, right? Like everyone, all the top minds in the world agree that if, you know, depending on how close you are to it, setting aside relativity, it's going to have a strong psychological and emotional effect on you.
Sure. And I mean, it's funny. Some of this stuff comes together out of a mix of practicality and sort of thematic aspirations. So, you know, on the practical side, when I decided that I wanted to set book two largely in a single system, the obvious question became, well, what makes it interesting, right? Like what makes this sort of big and exciting and sense of wonder evoking and Star Wars-y? So, you know, on that side of my brain, I'm sort of just searching through sort of, what would be cool? Jungle planets or, you know, whatever. And then the other side of my brain is sort of looking for the ideas that are going to resonate with some of the larger scale themes at play in the book. And of course, you know, the notion of this black hole at the center of the system that is just sort of absorbing light from everywhere that is having this constant pull, you know, is a fairly obvious source of metaphors and, you know, fun thematic elements and motifs to play with. Now I don't remember, you know, at exactly what moment I went, yes, black hole, that's the way to do it. But it's always kind of a balance of those two things for a lot of the stuff.
It is a great metaphor for what's happening around them and to the characters, right? I mean, you go down the list, time, change, you know, all these different things, density, all these different things that are going on, and or even like the universe sort of self, you know, course correcting itself from years of war and stuff like that. Is that, you know, are these the sort of things that you think about? Because even another, you know, there's another huge theme, inevitability, you know, obviously we'll talk about Chas, but like religion and spirituality, which sort of, you know, goes against, you know, the principles and theory behind a black hole, right? So you've got, there's that strong duality there at the same time. Is that the way you sort of look at these things, or am I just way overshooting it?
No, I don't think you're overshooting it. You know, some of it is in there from the sort of conception stage, and then other bits are sort of teased out during the writing process, right? The little moments where it's like, oh yeah, actually, what this character is going through, actually, it makes sense to use an analogy here that's going to fit with the larger scheme of things. And I think, I mean, I think there is an element of if you weave all that together reasonably well, that readers are going to start to create their own connections even when that was not consciously intended by the writer, and that's a good thing, right? Once you create that network, that framework, that sort of set of literary tools, if the reader is engaged in interacting with it and building their own links, like I think that's what a good book does. So I don't want to claim that like every single thing that you noticed is something that I planned. but I don't think it's a bad thing that you're noticing things that I did not necessarily intend in that particular sentence.
Sure. because we have one of the things, Elizabeth, you mentioned it, and Alex, you mentioned it. You know, Alex's concern is writing his story, but you are, Elizabeth, you're beholden to a larger Star Wars canon timeline. And one of the issues that books and movies and all these things have is when you introduce all these great new characters, you oftentimes have to maybe think about where they are afterwards, right? What happens to them, where they are in the current timeline, what happens to them? Is that, as he's introducing so many new characters, are you just like, hold on a second?
Well, it's really nice with the self-contained nature. Self-contained isn't the right word, but the freedom that Alex has with this series and the, you know, we'll just all see what happens in book three. Who knows?
Right.
But definitely just in general and with this book specifically, me and my team are always looking for ways to have characters appear in other stories or have themes referenced that it'll just always, as long as you don't overplay your hand and it's like, oh, really, everybody knows each other. I think it does help the universe feel cohesive and lived in, like in the novelization of Rise of Skywalker, when all of the rebellion ships show up at the end to help. There's one of the people who calls in is someone from Alphabet Squadron. And, you know, that person isn't gendered and who knows who they are. But definitely Tom Holler is the editor of that book. And he reached out to Alex to be like, hey, is this okay if we put that in there? And that's the kind of like really cool collaboration that happens with a storytelling universe with not one single author.
Yeah, and if I can add something there, like I remember getting that email from Tom and thinking like, well, you know, do I want to commit to that? And then, you know, I sort of thought it through and I'm like, well, you know, there's more, there are plenty of ways to explain that if need be, and it's more interesting if I say yes, right? Like it's always better to share the toys. It makes for a better, you know, experience across the board.
You're also just doing Tom a huge favor because he had 10,000 ships to fill. So he had the right. He had to, but to your point, you left it open too. Like you don't know who it is, right? So I mean, it's you've got time to figure that out.
Or someone else does.
Or somebody else does. Yeah, fair enough. Speaking of, you just said gender. Do you want to finally put to bed Ito's programming?
Oh, I mean, Ito is non. You know, Ito's a droid, right? Like.
Well, come on,
you can try to gender a droid.
No, I know, but it's come up a few times with other droids, and you can give them masculine, feminine programming, right? So I just I know you left it. You know, you referred to as they a lot and stuff like that. So it's sort of just like a funny joke more than anything else. I wanted to get at you because there's a great scene at the, I can't even talk about that scene. one of the great things that, like I said, a couple times, you've really introduced some great new characters. What's your strategy with when you introduce a new character into an established story, Alex, because you're basically, Soren's getting almost a full introduction here too, in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you still got work, you know, you're still working on all the other characters. They've got all their stuff they're going through, but at the same time, you know, you're introducing them, you know, new planets, new systems, new ships, new crews. What's your strategy with introducing new characters? You're like, you know, they can't be like super great because I don't want to take away from what's happening with the main folks. I mean, a couple like Vera Flan, like I need to know more about Ver. And like big time. And the governor, Yadiz, am I saying it right?
Yeah.
She's great. She's one of my favorite characters in this book. Again, somebody else I'd love to see more from. Do you talk and Elizabeth maybe with the comment on his thorough outlining? Is there more? Do you really map these characters out or just enough what you need to for the sake of this book?
I generally only know what I need when it comes to characters. And, you know, sometimes that's what I need for multiple books if, you know, if they're going to keep showing up. But I don't develop like massive backstories on paper for characters where those backstories don't have immediate impact within the story. I know there are writers who do that. That's just not the way I approach story structure. I know what these characters need to do. I have them do it, and maybe stuff builds up around them over time, right? Like if I've got a tertiary character who keeps showing up and, you know, I needed to throw some sort of personality on them just so that they weren't a complete cipher, that personality may expand a little over the course of the book, that and that might not have been in the outline. But any character of sort of more significance, I kind of know, okay, what are they doing? Who are they? And not really a lot beyond what shows up on the page.
Right. Is that, Elizabeth, is that something you sort of feel like you need to temper sometimes, just in general, when you're editing books? And I don't mean stifle, right? Certainly not creativity, but have you ever encountered, not with Alex now, just any situation where it's like, okay, you guys, you know, you've got a lot of great characters, but maybe you've got too many great characters.
Oh, I don't know that that's the case. I really liked how you described that, Alex, about just needing to know the outlines of people for what you need. I think that really resonates with me. Like, you know, my favorite author is Kurt Vonnegut, and I think what is great about him are all the sentences he doesn't write. All of the white spaces, you're going to get three lines that describe a character, and what you don't know about them is actually what makes them feel so real and vibrant. And I feel like that's, you know, I'm basically saying that Alex Fried is as good a writer as Kurt Vonnegut, and Alphabet Squadron is a masterpiece. But I think it has that same feeling to me of it can actually be more compelling to just get these flashes of people that your mind begins to fill in to create the relatable person.
Right. Let's get this book is Alphabet Squadron. Let's talk about Alphabet Squadron. And hopefully most people have seen the cover by now. I guess there's a small sort of like narrative tip of the hat on the cover if anybody wants to look closely enough about what you can expect for Shadowfall. But not only who's on the cover, but the formation of the alphabets on the cover. So Chaz really has her time. Chaz has a rough go in a lot of ways. Alex, you really,
Most of the characters, you really have it pretty easy. Right?
I don't know. I think
I was picking on her, but
I'll give you another compliment. I don't ever feel like you're picking on any character. that's for sure, right? I've never felt that. But Chaz has a tough go, and for me personally, I always take a little bit of extra interest when somebody puts a character through some type of like, you know, like a moral edification to the point where they encounter religion. Mm-hmm. I'm an atheist myself, so I'm always fascinated with that draw. You know what I mean? Because I don't feel it. So I'm always curious to know the people that do when they do feel it. So I'm like try and get them to describe, like, I know what a peach tastes like to me. What does it taste like to you? Right. So talk about sort of introducing the idea to get Chaz in front of every time I see Guyver, I always think of like MacGyver. I don't know why, but
that's the twist in book three.
Spoilers, Alex, come on.
But. Talk about the idea to have, first of all, I love, you know, the scene where she's stranded and floating in space and running low on oxygen. It's wonderful. Just talk about sort of having Guyver, the chilling empty sun, pick her up, and she goes to Katadra, and then she has, I mean, a really, really, really big moment there, life-changing, right?
Yeah. I mean, so a lot of it came from a mix of places. So some of Chaz's sort of religious interest was established in book one. You know, I say that, but now that I think about it, no, I had the plan for Chas gets involved in a cult from the very, very first sort of series pitch outlines. That was always going to be part of her journey. And, you know, that came from a couple of different places, you know, from the, again, sort of looking at the artsy stuff and the practical stuff. You know, the practical stuff was, oh, you know, this is something that hasn't been explored a whole lot that makes sense as an evolution out of the post-Endor period, right? Like, the Empire is no longer there cracking down on religions. You're going to get some interesting stuff out of that, and not all of it is going to be, you know, Church of the Force or Jedi wholesomeness. Some of it is going to be a little more ambiguous in its worth and meaning. So that just, it seemed like an interesting area to explore in the time period. But then also, you know, we're looking at a group of characters that is fundamentally, they have suffered and they have been damaged by this war, and the question becomes, you know, what is going to become of them now that the war is finally ending? You know, how are they going to find paths in life that resonate with them? And, you know, I think there are many people in similar situations where religion becomes a meaningful part of that, as well as the sort of, you know, those are the sorts of people that cults pick up. And, you know, seeing that, oh, yes, this is unexplored, you know, but interesting and relevant territory, and it works with the themes, well, you know, bring it all together, smoosh it into a ball, and book two is sort of where the natural place to bring that up was going to show.
Part of the, like, so much of her identity was her music, and so you've ripped that away from her and replaced it with a bunch of Tony Robbins, you know, self-help tapes. She's going to play those tapes. There's no way she doesn't. But is there anything in Shadowfall that indicates where these characters may end up at the end of all this? Is that, are we that far along yet, or are you still sort of like, you got a few more jabs before they can start to figure out? Like you said, one of the big things too, I talked about in my review is, you know, who are these people if they're not seeking revenge or if they're not fighting in a war? And we got to start to, at some point, you got to start transitioning these characters to a life after. Is this sort of, you know, is there any indication in what Chas is doing in this novel? And it's kind of, I guess this is territory you probably can't even answer. You might not even know yet. Is this the path you saw for Chas from the beginning, I guess maybe is the best way to put it?
Yes. And what I would say, you know, I don't want to say like, oh, there are no surprises whatsoever in book three. Really, you don't need to buy it. If you've read book two, you can pretty much figure it out from there. To a certain extent, it's true, right? Like, you know, the characters, their paths are very well established by the end of book two. And book three is really about concluding their journeys and figuring out, you know, what their final decisions are going to be, how they are going to combine and affect one another. But their big sort of pivot points as characters, I think, have largely been established by the end of book two.
Elizabeth, have you ever edited a trilogy before or anything?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah. I started at Del Rey. The first book that I worked on wholesale was Life Debt. So I didn't work on the first Aftermath, but was able to see that trilogy conclude.
Right.
So that was a little bit different. But no, this is definitely my first from beginning to end.
Because, you know, it just dawns on me listening to Alex think, and we're talking about the story wrapping up already, right? It's because it's just inevitable. But, you know, you're with this one from beginning to end, you're part of the process, you're part of the creative process. I'm just curious, you know, where you are emotionally with the story and the characters, having edited or almost edited a complete trilogy now, if that's, you know, just how do you describe the experience of getting to do that?
Oh, I'm way too invested. It's actually funny. My first editorial to letter to Alex, when I got the book 3 outline on it, was definitely preambling, saying, at this point, I've lived with these characters so long, and I love them so much, and I really have to take stock of professionally taking a step back and not just saying, but this is what I wanted to happen because I love them all, you know, which is not going to result in the best book. So that's been an interesting difference on working on a trilogy, just because you just love all these disaster pilots so much and you just want what's best for them, but as an editor you have to want what's best for the book.
I also want to jump in there and, you know, note, you know, Elizabeth has been very supportive of making this into a trilogy rather than 3 standalone books that basically connect. You know, that was one of the first questions that I had when I really got into planning this thing. And she was like, well, yeah, we don't do a lot of pre-planned trilogies, so go for it, make this one continuing storyline. And that, you know, that entails some risks to it, both creative and I imagine commercially. And yeah, I'm grateful that we've been able to do this as one sort of mega story.
Yeah, like that, something you just said there too is dawns on me, like these pilots, like, you know, like great. I'm thinking, like, I've seen, you know, sort of like rock stars and people say, like, they're only happy when they're on stage an hour a day, right? And I think I can't remember who the famous quote was, but they're saying, you know, it's like great on stage, bad at life. I think that about all the Alphabets. Like, they're all, I mean, such great pilots. They're all, you know, if they could find balance in their life, I mean, they'd be unbeatable. but that, maybe that's not an exciting story to read either, I guess, right? A bunch of satisfied, happy pilots.
That seems pretty good at life. It's maybe a horrifying life, but he's pretty comfortable.
Okay, fair enough. All right, point taken. Well, let's talk about Nath and Will. So Nath is an interesting, for sure, because he's sort of like, he fulfilled his mission in a lot of ways in book one, right? He got the revenge he thought he wanted anyways. The credit thing sort of is starting to like wear itself thin, like the doing it for credits. So he's taken on this real big brotherly role with Will, who, because Hera has taken off to support Vanguard, Will is forced into a leadership position. Nath is like, is this, you know, the veteran of the group, I guess, the scruffy veteran. So just talk about sort of that idea, that relationship between Nath and Will, and Will is like his maturation process has like skyrocketed, right? Like by the end of this book, he's really taken on a strong leadership role and is earning, you know, the kudos from all the right people.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Nath is that I think probably all of the other pilots, regardless of whether or not they were pilots, they would still, maybe a little less so with Will, but their struggles are largely internal or related to, you know, the world around them rather than with the rest of the squadron. Whereas Nath's struggle is primarily about how he's dealing with these other people. You know, like you said, his journey kind of resolved, or, you know, or at least the journey that he saw himself on resolved in book one. Now he's stuck with these people, and he needs to figure out what to do with that, especially as the stakes get higher, as, you know, things become more legitimately dangerous. And Will has always been sort of the one that he's bonded with most. You know, Will is the person who both knows Nath for who he is, but also kind of wants to bring out the best in him. And they, yeah, they've had this sort of fraternal relationship for book one, and that becomes a more significant part of book two. And yeah, I mean, if you want to look at it as sort of an older brother, younger brother thing, then certainly as Will gets these additional responsibilities put on him, it becomes this question for Nath about, well, is this kid going in the wrong direction? You know, is there something that I should be doing for him? Do I just let him make, you know, make his mistakes? What's my role in this? And, you know, do I even want to be involved?
The thing I like about Will is that he's getting further and further away from his return date, right? His return home date. And,
yes.
And he's, you know, you make mention of several instances where he hasn't heard from somebody in a while, or he hasn't written to somebody in a while. And those gaps are getting bigger and bigger. Is Will turning into a lifer here, do you think? Or do you see a back to, you know, Paulinus future for him? Is like, what's a happy ending look like for Will, do you think?
Well, I mean, I know the answer to that, and I'm hesitant to say much about it. I mean, I think you've hit on the key question for Will, right? Is, you know, he has sort of become trapped in this cycle of, okay, I'll stick around a little longer. And, you know, at what point does that force him to, you know, either make a decision to sort of reexamine the sort of person that he's become? Yeah, and that's the big question mark hanging over his head.
Elizabeth, what was your reaction to, so this is getting into somewhat heavier spoiler territory, but what was your reaction by the end of this book? I don't even have to really say it maybe, but I can say this much. What was your reaction of where we end the book with Yurka, where she is by the end of this book? What was your, if there's a lead in this trilogy, it's her, mm-hmm. I guess, right? I mean, it begins with her, and I assume it'll mostly end with her, and her path in this book is chapter 18, guys. And the title of that too, what would you take with you? Of course, a reference to Empire. Talk about your reaction to how the position she's in by the end of this book. Let's keep away from the details, because
sure.
it'll be a nice surprise, I think, for people. But just sort of, if you can, what you thought about that.
I mean, my reaction in a spoiler-free way was, oh, no, what? How? But maybe? I don't know. Was basically that. But in a more articulate way, I'm just so excited for her. I'm so excited to read book three with her in the place she is now, and seeing how that affects her relationships with the other alphabets. Erica is my favorite. I think she is such an interesting, unique character. I don't know that I've quite ever read someone like her before. So anytime she's put in an uncomfortable situation and you see what comes out, I'm here for it.
She's only in uncomfortable situations, right? Like, and you know, I couldn't agree more. She is one of the most interesting, complex characters I've ever read. You know, I've never seen somebody struggle so much. And one of the things I guess we can say about this book is, in a lot of ways, sort of the gig is up. A lot of her alphabet all the alphabet squadron, a lot of her past gets revealed to them in this book. And so they are forced to decide, you know, do they want to continue fighting with her or not? So a big part of her journey in this book, Alex, is you strand her on a planetoid. She goes through, I don't know what sort of you were thinking of. I mean, it's like, it's not internal damnation, that's for sure, but it's almost just like purgatory in a way. You know, talk about that chapter 18 where she's on this, actually it's a few chapters, but when she's on the planetoid and they find something really cool from a long time ago, and you've got this sort of like psychometric key she has to unlock, right? Talk about having to face your fears and your demons. You really put her through that.
Yeah, and you know, to a certain extent, it's a really cheap trick to put a character just directly against something that's going to mess with their head, right?
Like, sure.
It's the easy way out of dramatizing internal conflict.
It's funny you say it's the easy way out, but like when you read it, like, man, you like. She goes through some stuff, you know what I mean? Like,
well, and
yeah,
I think
I understand what you're saying, but yeah.
No, well, and I think for it to work, you need to deploy it judiciously, right? Like there is, you know, it's a hammer blow, and you can't have just constant hammer blows across, you know, an entire book. But if you throw in one, it gets your attention.
Sure, it's a big one.
And yeah, I mean the. Quell gets stranded and has to deal with the stuff that she has been sort of hiding from. That was another one of those ideas that was in my, you know, very, very first sort of couple of pages of notes when planning out the trilogy, right? The specifics weren't there. You know, Cerberon wasn't there. I don't remember, you know, if the other characters were involved in my head at that point, but I knew that, you know, this is a character who has been running away from her internal conflicts for, you know, a book and a half at that point. At some point, she's going to have to face that, and, you know, trapping her somewhere without a lot of distractions just kind of feels like the natural answer to that. And I did want her to confront that at some point. I didn't want it to sort of explode and crumble or sort of take a road less traveled path. Like I wanted that. Yeah, you need to face up to who you are moment.
But did it have to be at the expense of certain things? you could have just done all that with, you know, you didn't have to. Alex, you're killing me. Other than Yurko, I think my favorite, couple of my favorite characters for sure. One of them is Kairos. I'm just completely fascinated with Kairos. She has an interesting go this book. She's actually out of it for a good chunk of it. She gets injured. But we learn a lot. We learn a lot about her and her relationship with Siren and Ido and their backstory, which, you know, I think a lot of people, I think it was directly referenced and it's been surmised. And so we get a lot of that. And like I said, we hear about this great new character, Viriflan. Like, we know so little about Vir, but I want to know so much more. But talk about coming out at the end of this thing, you know, her swaddle is starting to come off. And she's starting to peel some layers in every way a person can, right? So talk about that one, you know, there's one chapter in particular that I was really thoughtful, and it's the one where, you know, we hear about the relationship between her and Ito and Siren. Talk about sort of you've been really methodical about revealing those details. Is that something that we are ever going to know the full story on, or are you somebody who likes to leave some things up to the reader?
A little of both. Like I do not feel the need to sort of explain and answer every question, but I want there to be enough that the reader can kind of feel like they piece together a reasonable answer in their own head. There's certainly more answers to come about who she is in book three and sort of where she comes from and her own views on all of this. But I think by the end of book two, you've got most, if not all, of those pieces. One of the things that's been, I think, delicate about Kairos is that She looks like a mystery from book one from a certain angle. She's not so much a mystery as she is in darkness, right? There are elements that we clearly don't know and have not been illuminated, but it's not like it's a plot point of who is that mysterious masked woman, right? Like no one within the world is particularly set on discovering, you know, what her past was or what she looks like under the mask. It's kind of just something that's going on, and it's an important part of her character, and seeing that sort of come to light across the trilogy is important. But sort of finding that balance where you're trying to have the reader be interested in who she is as a character without kind of overemphasizing, like, hey, is it actually Anakin Skywalker under there? it's always a tricky.
Well, we definitely don't know. We definitely know it's not Anakin.
or do we?
Or don't we? And Elizabeth, it's a good point too for you. Like, is there there's so many. You know, God, as Star Wars fans, this is what we do, right? We grab onto, you know, these background characters, not that she's a background character necessarily, but and obsess over them. Is there any characters that in this book that you find that you're rooting for and maybe make suggestions to Alex under the guise of it's a smart editorial decision, but really you just want to see that person live or die?
Oh my gosh. I mean, absolutely, I have those feelings, but I mean, like, kind of like what I said before, it's just really important to when you can have those moments where you're enjoying a story just like a fan, but then take that step back and say, well, what's right for the book, even though that moment you're referring to also ripped my heart out. And I was like, Alex, why? And he's like, because it's the right thing for the book. And I was like, God damn it, it is the right thing for the book.
I hate it when you're right.
Exactly.
as a writer with in a book with so many characters, with so many leads, do you resist the urge to like one more than the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is partly where planning in advance helps, right? Like, having that roadmap helps me avoid being overly sentimental about sort of how I handle these characters, or, well, you know, I just really feel like writing more of this character, you know, this week because of where I am in my life, and they end up sort of taking up a little more page space. Having the touchstones to go back to of, okay, what is this story about? Where are these characters going? Lets me focus on the execution of that rather than how I've developed any particular feelings about them as I've gone. And I do develop those feelings, right? Like, you know, there are characters in there that, you know, I had a grand old time writing, but where I go like, well, no, there's a reason I plan to kill that person off, you know, a third through the book, and they're gone. I can always write something else someday with a character who evokes similar ideas in me if I need to revisit those themes. But
sure, transfer
but
their
this
soul.
Story, yeah. They're out.
I don't want to keep you guys too much longer here. One of the things that, like I said, you don't really piggyback. You do, like, the book is full of sort of like, I don't really like saying Easter eggs, but there's a few. But you do, you know, Ray Sloan. Grad and annual Ray Sloan shows up because, you know, this book takes place in a certain time, and we're learning so much about this time period because of, you know, the last trilogy of films and sort of what's happening, and the decision to have, you know, have Ray Sloan be the Grand Admiral and be the sort of de facto leader of the Imperial War Machine at this point. And just, is that something, you know, you sort of throw those in, and we know that Soren has a date with her now. Are you allowed to say if we're going to have more, if we're actually going to have Ray Sloan as a character in the third book? A meaningful part, maybe I'll say, other than just because, like, she's in one meeting with, she's referred to and then has a meeting, right, with Soren in this book. And it seems like, you know, he's got a rendezvous with her. And I'm just wondering if we're allowed to talk about if she's going to have more of a presence in the third book.
Well, how about we say this? I am such a fan of Ray Sloan. She's such an amazing character. And so I always root for as much of her as possible in any book. I do think that this isn't necessarily her story, right? That again, letting that fan self take over and being like, okay, book three, it's just a Renée Sloan love letter, would detract from what's right for the story, where I think Soren is really centered as the Imperial presence. Is that fair to say, Alex?
Oh, I think that's fair to say. You know, the other thing that I will delicately add to that, and hope that I'm not going to get myself in trouble, is you know, the timeline around Renée Sloan gets complicated at this point in the story. So there are places where we can use her, and there are places where we just can't. She's, you know, she's otherwise engaged. She's a busy woman.
Speaking of looming, the messenger just won't die.
Gosh, just it's so won't good. Die. I love it.
So the messengers,
those things well.
I very well. I love that scene where Governor Yadiz, you know, tells Soren she's got a gift for him, present for him, and she rolls out the messenger. It's just like the worst thing. The last thing Soren wants to see is this damn thing. He can't get rid of it. It's kind of a funny scene, actually. It's very tongue in cheek. Is that something that, you know, it's like the Emperor's shadow is long. I think it's is an exact quote, right, from Kairos in the first novel. Is that sort of something you always want to make sure that's there? And it's a constant reminder that, you know, no matter what's happening, there's still sort of grander things at work.
Yes. I mean, part of it is just the messenger is a nice concrete reminder of the just exorbitant evil that the Empire arose from. That's part of it. There are also aspects of it that, you know, I don't want to get into too much. We are not done with the just pure utilitarian plot significance of the messenger either.
Okay. It's tough to get talk about too much. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of surprises in this book, and I don't want to spoil them for people. So I think maybe now is a good spot to sort of cut this off, because, you know, we start talking about certain characters and there's certain things happened at certain points in the book that – you know, a lot of people I think are going to be caught off guard by. So maybe it's best to, as nice as a spoiler conversation we're having, maybe it's best to leave it at that and let people experience the book. Like I was able to experience it, you know, spoiler free and not knowing anything. So sometimes take that for granted, maybe. I will say thank you so much for the sea shanty. The Corellian sea shanty there. That was, did you write a whole thing? Because that's just like a section of it.
I did not write anything beyond that, but it was a joy to put that thing together. I have a deep, long-running weakness for ridiculous sailing songs, whether sort of proper sea shanties or sort of, you know, naval anthems or whatever, right? Like I've got a lot of them just rolling around in my head. I can do a couple of good verses of, you know, Patty Lay Back or All For Me Grog or whatever at any given time. So slipping that in was great fun.
I don't know if we'll give a quick shout out then to, I don't know if you ever, the new Noelle Stevenson's She-Ra series on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen that at all. There's a character called Seahawk in it who is a pirate, and but he's a nice pirate. If you like sea shanties, check that show out, man. That guy, he's great. He's a great character, and he's always doing something. Elizabeth, I would very much appreciate it if you would order Alex to finish this sea shanty, please.
All right. Book okay. Three, all of the shanties.
It's okay. This is going to be probably a non-answer, but is there anything at all you're allowed to tell us about book three? Anything?
Ooh. It is first drafted in English.
Okay.
And it has.
Is the outline in? Is the outline? Have you handed the outline in? Is that?
Oh yeah.
Okay. All right. So we're there. We're moving along then. Okay. Talk about who's on the cover.
Well, we'll just have to see.
Okay.
It's a great character.
You know, I think I can give a very, very, very vague tease on book three. So sure. What I will say is in my head, book one was the techno thriller, right? Book one was kind of Tom Clancy, crazy stuff going on in a lot of different places, high stakes, but a lot of sort of individual missions. Book two was sort of a more full-on war novel. Book three, in my mind, has always been the space opera, right? Book three is where the big emotions just match perfectly with the big conflicts and where everything erupts in fire.
Everything erupts in fire. We have the copy.
That's the quote right there. Everything here. Oh, well, then that's a great spot to end it. So Star Wars Shadowfall comes out June 23rd, as of right now, unless that changes by the time we get there. I can't thank you both enough for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Alex, I love this book so much. I can't wait for people to read it, a mass audience to read it, get a hold of this thing. I think people are really going to lose their minds. I think it's that great. And even though Elizabeth is giving you, it sounds like most of, if not all the credit, I think she gets some credit too, because this package, right? Just looking at it from that point of view is just so fantastic. It's so great to read. It flows great. The rhythm is great. The meter's fantastic. I can't say enough about it. You've crafted such a great story, you guys, and I just cannot wait for the third book. So, okay, thanks so much to Alex and Elizabeth for coming by. What a great discussion that was. I'm going to have Alex back in about a month's time once everyone's had a chance to read the book, so we can go really deep and have a really, really, really good spoilery discussion. There's a couple characters in particular I really want to talk to him about. Like I said, Shadowfall is out. Wherever you buy your books, make sure you pick one up. I recommend independent stores if you've got one nearby. Of course, there's plenty online to choose from. We've got some really great shows coming up, too. Look forward to interviews with Cole Horton. He's got a couple new books coming out. And Sam Maggs has a really great book coming out called The Unstoppable Wasp. So look forward to that one. So until then, take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.